schools has been involved in terrorism, John Brennan reported. They're just hell because they're Taliban. The CIA assessed that Karkhwa, the former Helmand governor, could be a threat, but he could also be good for reconciliation. Over hours, they reviewed the prisoners' files and various intelligence assessments. Daniel Freed, a career diplomat who served as a special envoy in charge of seeking the closure of Guantanamo, argued that the record of Qatar and like Gulf states in preventing international travel by former prisoners was poor. McDonough pushed the group to assess the worst case. What if the five prisoners did go back to the war? Would it really be much of a military setback for NATO or the Afghan government? They were looking to bring an American home and to explore a political settlement that could stabilize the region. There were risks in every direction. None of these guys are game changers, Brennan said. The problem, they agreed, wasn't the law. The detainees' case files suggested they were eligible for release. The problem wasn't military risk. These were graying political types, and even if they escaped and tried to fight the United States, they would not alter the war. The problem, as always with Guantanamo, was politics. As Freed put it, we have to be ready for a hysterical reaction on Capitol Hill. But the main issue for now was finding a way to enforce a travel ban through Qatar that would stick. At Bonn, Germany, in December 2001, Hamid Karzai had been selected as chairman of the post-Taliban interim authority in Afghanistan. 10 years later, with al-Qaeda diminished and bin Laden dead, but the Taliban on the march, international diplomats reassembled there. The idea was to reaffirm global solidarity with Afghanistan and to support a new phase of Afghan and regional peace negotiations. Grossman hoped to announce the opening of a Taliban office in Doha within months after the Bonn conference. This would be the biggest advance in diplomacy with the Taliban in a decade. Grossman asked a team of aides to research past negotiations of this character between Israel and the Palestinians at Madrid and between factions of the Bosnian War at Dayton as orchestrated by Holbrooke. Grossman interviewed Henry Kissinger about how the Vietnam talks had been structured. His staff prepared a memo describing a refined approach to decisive negotiations in Turkey as soon as the summer of 2012, supported by international governments. Most of the classified memoranda of understanding necessary to open the office, providing guarantees about what the office would and would not be used for, had by now been agreed in principle among the Taliban, the United States, and Qatar. Grossman would travel from Bonn to meet Tayyip Aga in Qatar, finalize terms for the Taliban office, and then finalize a Taliban statement denouncing terrorism. The idea was that Hamid Karzai would endorse the Taliban political office as an important step toward peace, as would many other governments. From that milestone, they would move quickly toward prisoner exchanges and fuller peace negotiations. On Sunday, December 4th, Grossman and Ryan Crocker met with Karzai in Bonn. As I have told you all along, Mr. President, we are now at a place where I am going to leave the Bonn conference in 2 days, and I am going to meet Tayyip Aga and complete the negotiation on the Taliban's political office in Qatar, Grossman said. Karzai blew up. Sometime between meeting Clinton in October and arriving in Germany, he had concluded once again that the Qatar office was proof that the United States planned to cut a separate peace with the Taliban, accommodating Pakistan, at his expense. He now refused to support the Qatar office on the terms Grossman outlined. He yelled at them and made wild accusations. "You betrayed me. You killed Rabbani," he said. He claimed that he had never heard any of this about Grossman's step-by-step plan toward peace talks. "Excuse me," Grossman replied. "I've seen you once a month during the Tayyip Aga saga." He, Ruggiero, and Steiner had kept Karzai fully informed. On the crazy accusation that they wanted Rabbani dead and had conspired in his assassination, Grossman said, "You can't talk to us like that." He and Crocker were flabbergasted. The next day, Karzai invited them and Hillary Clinton to join him for lunch at his hotel. He ripped into Clinton, too, although he refrained from accusing her of murdering Rabbani. Karzai insisted that only he could grant the Taliban the concession of a political office, not the United States. They were all flummoxed and frustrated, but Clinton said they had to accept that Karzai was the sovereign leader of Afghanistan. "Listen, he's our ally," she said. They had many equities in Afghanistan, troops, NATO's commitments, and counterterrorism programs. "We have to take his views into account." Grossman agreed. He thought he could just work Karzai's terms forward, that they weren't impossible to manage. Crocker thought he understood Karzai's decision, and in some respects he agreed with him. These were not Karzai's talks. He could not control them, and the Americans' willingness to talk to the Taliban without Karzai, even preliminarily, signaled his weakness. If the American talks succeeded, Karzai might well lose control of events. That could be dangerous. If he refused to cooperate, there was less chance that he would become vulnerable. Grossman canceled his scheduled meeting with Tayyip Aga in Doha and returned to Washington. In January, he flew to Kabul to see if he could bring Karzai back into the negotiation. But in a meeting at the Arg Palace, Karzai presented what some Americans involved came to describe as his three poison pills, meaning terms that Karzai knew or should have known were too onerous to be accepted. First, the Qataris had to travel to Kabul to explain the Taliban political office to Karzai. Second, there had to be a memorandum of understanding negotiated between Karzai's government and the Taliban. Third, before the office opened, the Taliban had to agree to meet with representatives of the Karzai government. The only positive thing he said about the negotiations to date was that he understood the Americans' humanitarian concern about winning the release of the Taliban prisoner Bo Bergdahl. He had no objection to a prisoner exchange, including one involving the Varsity Five, if that was the reason. But he was dead set against Grossman's original terms for opening a Taliban political office. As a diplomat, Grossman was a facilitator, a man of process and professional tradition. All along, he accepted the stated policy of the Obama administration that peace talks were to be Afghan-led. He made no effort, as a Holbrooke or Petraeus might have done, to tell Karzai that he was full of crap and that he had to cooperate here and now, that the future of peace in Afghanistan was too important for Karzai to let his ego or his illusions of power stand in the way. Grossman had instructions from Hillary Clinton that there was too much at stake in the alliance with Karzai to blow up the relationship over deal points in this incipient negotiation. If they defied Karzai or bullied him, he might go public and denounce the United States for negotiating secretly with the Taliban without his permission, which would be a devastating accusation in Congress, among other places. The Taliban believed Washington had decisive leverage over Karzai because he could not survive without their aid. The truth was, Karzai had established decisive leverage over the Obama administration by taking their pledges of Afghan sovereignty at face value. In essence, Grossman told Karzai, "Okay, Mr. President, I'll take this forward." He flew on to Doha to present Karzai's terms to Tayyip Aga. Grossman's assumption was that this might be just another twist in the road that could be negotiated to a compromise. Others on his team thought it was definitely the end of the road. When they were gathered around the table at the Doha compound, Grossman read out Karzai's new requirements. "Our allies, the Afghans, have kind of changed their mind," Grossman conceded, "and we have a responsibility to them." The Taliban envoy recoiled. He was plainly furious, as were the Qataris. From the Taliban's perspective, Karzai was merely an American puppet, one that depended on American support for money and physical survival. It seemed obvious that Karzai could be forced to do whatever the Americans wanted. Tayyip Aga said he and the Taliban Political Commission had taken great risks internally to negotiate with the Americans, and now, out of the blue, with some lame reference to Karzai, the Obama administration had upended agreed terms. They had made a deal, down to fine points, for the political office in Qatar. Now the Americans were tearing up the agreement. They did not seem to hear what Tayyip Aga had been saying on behalf of the Taliban leadership all along. They would not deal with Karzai, a quisling of no legitimacy. "We reject the role of Kabul administration in office opening, prisoner transfer, and will only continue talks and negotiations with the United States after office and transfer is concluded," the Taliban reported back in a written message passed by the Qataris. They would not talk to Karzai's representatives at present stage or negotiation stage later, because it had now been proved to all that Mr. Karzai is playing in the hands of others and has no power of decision-making. Those at the Pentagon who had been monitoring the talks were appalled. They felt Grossman had been too accommodating of Karzai. They also felt he had envisioned the negotiations too narrowly, and that his plan was just to get Afghans to talk to Afghans after the Taliban had an office address, whereas what was needed was a much more comprehensive, strategic approach worked out with Karzai in advance. In the later search for blame, a number of Grossman's colleagues wondered whether he had done all he should have to keep Karzai and the Pakistanis on his side as the high-risk talks with Tayyip Aga ripened. Grossman seemed to them too careful, too self-protecting. He did not spend the long hours over meals to cultivate Karzai, as Zalmay Khalilzad had done. He did not project the forceful energy of Richard Holbrooke. Grossman's defenders admitted that he was no Holbrooke, but argued that he was intelligent, experienced, methodical, and diligent, and that the fault wasn't his, but Karzai's. Another hard truth was that although the president had strongly encouraged the effort, the Obama administration had not brought the full weight of its power or the breadth of its government to the process. Neither the director of the CIA nor the Secretary of Defense supported Grossman's efforts. They were the ones who, in a pinch, had the clout to try to coerce Karzai. In any event, the failure was a bitter one for the State Department, White House, and Pentagon officials who had been working weekends and endless hours for more than a year to try to negotiate an exit from America's longest war. The two sides traded a few more desultory notes, but in early March 2012, the Taliban announced publicly their withdrawal from negotiations with the United States. In the Taliban's own strategy of fight and talk, they were returning to war. Chapter 32. The Afghan Hand. Sent, Sunday, April 10th, 2011, 7:40 a.m. 2. Loftus email. Subject, re, arrived in Kabul. We finished our classes today. The language classes were very useful, and some of the culture classes were interesting, but there was a lot of PowerPoint as well. Worse yet, it was Afghan PowerPoint. The older I get, the harder it is to stay awake during boring presentations. We have so far had a mullah, some elders, an Afghan general, and a member of parliament come and speak to us. They were all very interesting. We had a mock shura for the last day of language training. I had to play the part of a village elder, and I had to speak Pashto and sometimes Dari, since the other students are split across both. There's a picture of me in an Afghan hat and shawl looking really tired. Remember my joke? What kind of Mexican food may or may not happen? Inshallah. An Arab-American who lives in California liked it, and he asked permission to use it. I, of course, agreed. John Darren Loftus, a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force, was 43 when he arrived in Afghanistan on his second tour. He had been drafted into the AFPAC HANDS program for Afghanistan and Pakistan, as a specialist in Afghan languages and culture. He was about 5 feet 8 inches and had a stocky Celtic build, as his wife Holly put it, referring to his Irish heritage. He had a soft neck, brown hair, and an open face. He was straight-laced, a committed Christian who seemed to go out of his way to identify the best in others. He avoided even mild profanity, but could be forthright and direct, even when speaking to superior officers. Officers who became AFPAC hands committed to at least 2 field tours in Afghanistan. Loftus studied foreign languages avidly, but he had been reluctant to join because it would require long separations from Holly and their 2 daughters, Allison, who was 12, and Camille, who was almost 10. Ultimately, however, senior officers in the Air Force had all but insisted that he become a hand because of his language ability. He was one of a handful of Pashto speakers in the Air Force. He and Holly felt he had no choice but to serve. Holly and the girls remained at the family home in Navarre, on the Florida Panhandle, near Hurlburt Field, home to the Air Force's 1st Special Operations Wing. The base had a view of a nearby bay. Airmen enjoyed picnics on the Gulf of Mexico's immaculate beaches. Loftus had been posted at the Schoolhouse, a facility at the U.S. Air Force Special Operations School. He taught officers and airmen about what they would encounter in Afghanistan. He shared the teaching load with a female Air Force intelligence officer who had immigrated to the United States from Afghanistan at the age of 12. She spoke native Pashto. Loftus had learned his Pashto at the Defense Language Institute in Monterey, California. The pair became fast friends while devising skits and role-playing games for their curriculum. When new military students arrived, Loftus and his partner would separate the men and women to introduce Afghanistan's gender segregation. They would ask the men to hold hands, as Afghan men do. They dressed female students in burqas so they would know what it was like to wear one. They walked their students through pretend Afghan villages so they could practice talking to wary residents. They recited poems in Pashto and Dari. Among the many roles Loftus played during schoolhouse skits, he was particularly brilliant as a tea server. Even when bantering Air Force generals tried to induce him to speak or break character, Loftus would bow his head and refuse to glance up to demonstrate his socially prescribed subservience. He painstakingly taught departing American generals an icebreaker they could memorize in Dari. A man knocks on his neighbor's door and asks to borrow his donkey. The neighbor says he has no donkey. "But I heard it braying." "Nope, no donkey," the neighbor insists. Just then arise the sounds of a donkey knocking around inside the house. "Who are you going to believe?" the exasperated man asks. "Me or the donkey?" The purpose of the AFPAC HANDS program was to leverage the expertise of American officers who served multiple tours in Afghanistan to help win over Afghan hearts and minds. It was a phrase Loftus didn't like because it can be twisted to just about anything, as he once put it. The schoolhouse curriculum was one aspect of the counterinsurgency campaign, but it also had a defensive purpose, to prevent misunderstandings between Americans and Afghan partners that might escalate into intimate violence. By 2011, this was a rising problem in the war. "Everything over there is about relationships," Loftus and his teaching partner emphasized. Yet there was an obvious tension in their curriculum. On the one hand, they taught, "Build relationships with Afghans who are your counterparts." At the same time, they warned, "Watch your back." Loftus had grown up in Murray, Kentucky, a town of about 15,000 in the southwestern corner of the state. He was the first in his family to attend college at Vanderbilt University in Nashville. He met Holly Brewer there. They lived in the same foreign language hall as sophomores. The residents were supposed to speak Spanish as much as possible. She was the daughter of a cardiologist and a school teacher. He had little money and made it through Vanderbilt on scholarships and loans. They bonded deeply. They both were children of divorce. They yearned to live abroad. The summer after they graduated, they married and applied to the Peace Corps. They assumed they would go to Latin America because they both spoke Spanish. One day, they got a call reporting that they had been assigned to Papua New Guinea, the island nation near the equator in the Pacific, one of the poorest countries in the world. In 1992, they arrived in the Southern Highlands, a remote forested area populated by the Duna people. They lived for 2 years in a village that had no electricity and no piped hot water. They both learned Melanesian Pidgin, a patois of English, German, and tribal languages. They also acquired a little Duna. The long months of working side by side amid such ingrained poverty changed our perspective on things, not bleeding heart, but more in just learning about development, to see how slowly things can happen and how everything can get caught up in local politics. In 1994, toward the end of their Peace Corps work, Darren thought about joining the military. He was 26. The Air Force accepted him into officer training school in Alabama. Loftus had studied engineering as well as languages at Vanderbilt. Commissioned as a second lieutenant, he became a missile man and worked on classified space and nuclear programs. Holly taught preschool for a while as they moved from base to base. On September 11, 2001, they were living at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio. Holly heard the news of the attacks on National Public Radio, then turned on CNN and sat in front of the television most of the day, shocked and transfixed. As George W. Bush's global war on terrorism unfolded, Darren was ordered to Schriever Air Force Base and then Cheyenne Mountain, the Cold War-era nuclear command bunker near Colorado Springs, Colorado. He hoped for a position in the Air Force that would use his gift for languages and enthusiasm for foreign cultures. Eventually, Darren applied to become a regional affairs strategist, an Air Force role that would require him to study a foreign language at Monterey. The application form asked what language he would prefer. Loftus wrote, "Needs of the Air Force," as his answer. His superiors chose Pashto. Major Jeffrey T. Borden arrived in Afghanistan on his latest tour in June 2008. He was a research psychologist who specialized in the causes of failed military and intelligence decision-making. He had also spent more than three decades serving in various branches of the military reserves, law enforcement, and the Air National Guard. Among other projects, Borden had conducted war crimes and human rights investigations in combat zones. After September 11th, he deployed to Afghanistan as a civil affairs planner, an advisor on law enforcement issues, and as a trainer of the Afghan National Police, working with U.S. Special Forces. He was deployed in areas that saw heavy combat, such as the Pech Valley, the Korengal Valley, and Nuristan. Borden's work contained an emphatic streak of skepticism about commanding generals. His doctoral dissertation at Claremont Graduate School had explored how elite governmental decision-makers come to ignore or refute valid information during their deliberations. The paper began by recounting how, during the late 1930s, naval officers discovered serious quality problems in torpedo manufacturing, yet the officers acquiesced to both political and organizational pressures to ignore the defects. Then, in 1942, at the Battle of Midway, nearly 100 American airmen flew torpedo-armed planes against a vastly superior Japanese force. Despite the Holocaust they were flying into, Borden recounted, every aircrew pressed their attack, many while literally engulfed in flames. Yet their bravery came to naught because not a single torpedo detonated against a Japanese warship. This failure enabled the Japanese to launch a devastating counterstrike that culminated in the loss of the USS Yorktown and 141 American lives. The title of Borden's work signaled his perspective on these and similar cases. Lethal Incompetence: Studies in Political and Military Decision-Making. Early in his career, Borden worried that he had been too hard on the commanders he chronicled. Later, he decided, I wasn't hard enough. By 2010, Borden had become all too familiar with a disturbing trend, a rising incidence of murder of American and European soldiers by uniformed Afghans who were supposed to be allies. The military called these murders green-on-blue killings. Since the spring of 2007, there had been more than 24 murder or attempted murder cases in Afghanistan, where soldiers or police working alongside American or European forces had turned their guns on their partners, killing at least 58. By 2010, the pace of fratricidal killings was rising, to the point where an Afghan ally murdered an American or European soldier once a week on average, according to Borden's findings. In July, an Afghan soldier killed 3 British troops in Helmand and then fled to the Taliban. A week later, an Afghan soldier killed 2 American civilian trainers in northern Afghanistan. The next month, an Afghan employee shot dead 2 Spanish police officers. Yet no one had ever ordered a study of the problem and its causes. Borden had been out on operations with the Afghan National Police in remote areas since 2004. On patrol, he had sometimes felt that he was just as likely to be shot in the back by an Afghan police officer as to be killed by a Taliban insurgent. There were always a handful of Afghan comrades alongside him who had a hard stare that Borden felt as hostility. He decided that an ethnographic study of the attitudes of Afghan and American soldiers toward one another might be insightful. The green-on-blue murders rising during 2010, and the shock effect they had on public opinion, particularly in Europe, threatened President Barack Obama's strategy to try to engineer an exit from the Afghan war without leaving violent chaos behind. At the heart of Obama's plan lay the counterinsurgency campaign now led by General Petraeus, which sought to suppress the Taliban long enough to train and equip Afghan security forces so that they could replace American and European troops and allow them to go home, starting in 2011. This expanding training mission required closer and closer interaction between American and European soldiers and Afghan allies. If such collaboration repeatedly gave rise to misunderstandings or resentments that led to cold-blooded murder, the strategy might fail. It required another tragedy to jolt the army to take an initial step to investigate as Borden proposed. On November 29, 2010, in the Pachir Agam district of eastern Nangarhar province, an Afghan border policeman participating in a joint operation with U.S. soldiers turned his gun on his allies and killed 6 Americans, the worst mass murder case involving the United States in the Afghan war to date, and among the worst of its kind in American military history. That attack at last led U.S. Army commanders to authorize a Red Team research project about the apparent alienation between Afghan trainees and foreign advisors. Red Team studies at the CIA or in military intelligence seek to step outside of prevailing assumptions. Regional Command East, as the section of the Afghan battlefield to the Pakistani side of Kabul was known, commissioned Borden to conduct a Red Team study into fratricidal violence in Afghanistan. He designed his ethnographic research so that it would meet the peer review standards of social science, but in essence, the design was simple. The Red Team researchers would ultimately ask more than 600 Afghan soldiers, police, and interpreters, as well as about 120 American soldiers, to talk openly about how they felt about one another. The team also asked another 136 American soldiers to fill out a questionnaire assessing their Afghan counterparts. Borden directly solicited comment on misunderstandings and grievances between the two groups. Okay, we won't give you the regular smiley face answers. We will tell you the truth, an Afghan National Army sergeant told his interviewers. The research team reached Laghman province on December 8, 2010. After Christmas, they tramped around Kunar and Nangarhar, through the end of January. They worked on Afghan bases, not American bases. The Afghan soldiers and police they interviewed offered a critique of American conduct that did not sound very different at times from the Taliban's critique. The Afghans said that the Americans carried out too many violent night raids, that their home searches looking for insurgents humiliated ordinary Afghans, that they did not respect Afghan women, that they drove local roads arrogantly, that they fired their weapons recklessly if attacked, and that they killed far too many Afghan civilians. They get upset due to their casualties, so they take it out on civilians during their searches, one interviewee explained. They take photos of women, even when we tell them not to, said another. A U.S. armored transport vehicle killed 6 civilians traveling in a vehicle. It was intentional. U.S. soldiers killed 2 youths. Their mother became a suicide bomber. She was provoked by this atrocity. She went to paradise as a martyr. They cause many civilian casualties. They apologize, but they keep doing it. This isn't acceptable. Borden's research team analyzed categories of complaint and built matrices to show which grievances stung most. They identified examples where the Afghan allies attributed violence to Americans that had actually been the Taliban's responsibility. The American officers and soldiers Borden interviewed also had a jaundiced view of the Afghans they were training and fighting alongside. They are stoned all the time. We can't leave anything out. They steal it. I wouldn't trust the ANA, Afghan National Army, with anything, never mind my life. I was fired on by ANA personnel multiple times during my deployment. It would benefit Afghanistan to disband the ANA and start over again. We are interfering with Darwinian theory. On May 12, 2011, Borden published a 70-page paper titled A Crisis of Trust and Cultural Incompatibility. It provided a raw, highly detailed account of estrangement between American and Afghan allies. The testimony in the report included some from American soldiers who described lethal attacks where they believed Afghan soldiers or police had partnered or been complicit with the Taliban. Borden found a rapidly growing systematic threat and a crisis of confidence among the Western trainers preparing the Afghan National Army and police to carry the war against the Taliban on their own. Borden was particularly scathing about what he described as a pattern of denial among American commanders. Generals dismissed green-on-blue killings as isolated and extremely rare, Borden wrote. Statements that seem disingenuous if not profoundly intellectually dishonest. The willful, cognitive dissonance of those leading the war perpetuates an ongoing blindness towards acknowledging this murder problem. His judgments implicated General David Petraeus, who by now had been named to lead the CIA. Petraeus had a doctoral degree in international relations from Princeton. He surrounded himself with Army officers who also were graduate degree holders, many of them social scientists. Yet, although he was often described as an intellectual, Petraeus did not have a particularly searching or questioning mind. He projected unshakable confidence, and he was masterful at shaping his own reputation. He understood as well that in an era of global media and asymmetric terrorism and insurgency, wars turned as much on what people thought as on the territory they controlled. Borden's work clearly undermined the public narrative of the Afghan war Petraeus had tried to shape. Colonel John Angevine had recently arrived at the ISAF headquarters to run Red Team studies. He read Borden's report, talked with the author about the possibility of working further together, and on June 3, 2011, told Borden that he was going to pass the study up to Petraeus. 3 days later, Borden learned that ISAF had ordered that his study be classified to prevent further distribution beyond those with appropriate clearances. The command had also declined to renew his contract and withdrawn an informal offer to further study mistrust between American and Afghan soldiers. Petraeus said later he had never heard of Borden, never read the study, and never took any steps to suppress its findings. Angevine had passed the study to Petraeus's command staff, but had no way to know whether the general had received it or looked at it. Angevine did conclude that Borden had broken trust with the command by publishing the study as an open-source document in a publicly accessible military knowledge-sharing database before he had authorization from the very top. Borden thought this was a shoddy excuse for suppressing his findings. He had published through the appropriate channels in a routine manner. He saw his work as the clarification of inconvenient truths in wartime, in the tradition he had long chronicled, and he believed his work undermined public statements by Petraeus about the war's progress. Without question, the work was inflammatory. In any event, ISAF did not renew Borden's contract. Someone else in Petraeus's command, it is not clear who, ordered a crisis of trust and cultural incompatibility to be classified. Angevine and other officers in ISAF discussed Borden's research and debated his conclusions. The question was whether cultural incompatibility was really the cause of fratricidal violence, or merely one of many contexts in which such intimate murders occurred, perhaps because of deliberate Taliban infiltration. It was a sensitive matter because the Borden thesis of fundamental incompatibility leading to repetitious mass murder offered weary European publics and politicians a clearly lit exit ramp out of an Afghan war they no longer wanted to fight. We've overstayed. They all hate us. It's hopeless. Borden had no alternative but to go home. He thought the transparent evidence he had assembled spoke amply for itself, and that the Petraeus command was in denial. As he departed Afghanistan, he thought privately, a lot of people are going to get killed unnecessarily. 2 weeks after Borden was effectively fired, a Wall Street Journal reporter obtained a copy of the study and wrote about it. A spokeswoman for Petraeus's command denounced Borden's work as methodologically flawed and not reliable. The position of Petraeus and his advisors was that they were aware of the problem of fratricidal violence and were taking preventive measures, many of them involving classified security procedures, to stop the killings to the degree possible. There was no way to stop all of the insider attacks, but they were aware of the threat and doing what they could. As Petraeus departed Kabul for the CIA, he and his staff organized transition briefings for Marine General John Allen, who would take command of ISAF on July 18th. Petraeus and his lieutenants presented to Allen at least 3 formal briefings on the Afghan war. In addition, the incoming commander dined with Petraeus almost every night. Not once, not even in staff-level briefings, did Petraeus or his officers mention the trend of fratricidal murder. Sent, Friday, November 11th, 2011, 3:10 a.m. 2. Loftus email. Subject, miss you. It has gotten cold here, too. I was on duty last night, and every time I stepped outside, I felt sorry for the guards who were out all night. They were bundled up, though, and one of them was watching TV in his cell phone. There's another one who is really friendly and really loud about it. He only speaks Dari, and he's illiterate. When I asked him if he could read, he said, "No, but I can really fight," and he started maneuvering around with his gun and making sounds. He's a real trip. I've been teaching him one phrase of English a day, and he is tickled to death. I've made really good friends with the janitor who cleans our building at ISAF. Today I introduced him to an AFPAC hand, Larry, who is still finding his feet in Dari. At the end of our basic conversation, Basir said his hope is that our children can be good friends, too. Another janitor, the one who cleans our part of the MOI building, doesn't have his fingers on his right hand. I finally got close enough to him to ask about it, and after he closed the door, he said it had been Taliban cruelty. I had suspected that. He then insisted that I translate it for Colonel Green, who was also in the room. You're the only other ones that I have told. He shakes our hands without any shame or discomfort, though. He also has 9 kids, and I got to meet one of them. Colonel Green got him a nice eyed present. I wish it were safe enough to bring you all here so you can see my world, but I like the one at home a lot better. L.D. 2. It had been apparent for years that Western military discipline and doctrine might be difficult to teach to Afghan soldiers and police, given that they struggled with high rates of illiteracy and impoverishment. Many American and European training officers had developed a nuanced appreciation of the problem. They did not expect Afghans to celebrate the presence of foreign troops in their country or to perform to the standards of armies in the industrialized world. The training mission was to prepare Afghans well enough to defend their own government and people against the second Taliban revolution, after the Americans and Europeans departed. They smoked strong hashish and mild opium. They couldn't map read, recalled Patrick Hennessy, a young British officer who, in 2007, oversaw the training of an Afghan Khandak, or battalion, in Helmand Province. They lacked everything that British Army training believed in and taught. And fuck me if most of them hadn't killed more Russians than we'd ever seen. I liked that they had more balls than I ever did to just stand up and say, why, or no, or I don't care if there is a war on and a massive IED threat. I like watermelon, so I'm going to steal a car I can't drive and run a Taliban checkpoint in order to go to the market. I couldn't train them at all. The potential for misunderstandings between F-bombing Western trainers and pious, prideful Afghan soldiers to erupt into gun violence was a problem too sensitive to put in the formal briefings, as Hennessy described it. But this gap did not seem to pose a strategic crisis. The murder rate grew only after 2007, as the war's violence spread, and as tens of thousands more American, Canadian, and European troops arrived to fight in Afghan cities and villages. It seemed remarkable that Afghans accepted the inevitability of American battlefield errors and the necessity of violent raids on private homes as much as they did. It was hardly surprising that personal bonds on joint bases frayed nonetheless as isolated American units lost discipline, killed civilians in the plain sight of Afghan partners, urinated on household walls in front of Afghan women, shot dogs for sport, or called their Afghan colleagues motherfuckers, even if the foreigners intended the phrase only in mild censorship. Increasingly, too, as it became clear that American and European troops would not remain in Afghanistan in large numbers for the long run, trainer and trained harbored distinct assumptions. The Americans and their Canadian and European allies were in a hurry to get the Afghan army and police organized so they could go home. The Afghan soldiers being trained could not withdraw from the challenge of the Taliban, so they were open to local truces and other improvised, even cooperative strategies with the enemy to avoid direct combat. During 2011, fratricidal attacks surged in number and lethality. On October 29th, an Afghan army trainee at a base in Kandahar province opened fire on Australian soldiers, killing 3 of them and wounding 7 others before the shooter was felled by return fire. On November 9th, an Afghan soldier shot and wounded 3 Australians in Uruzgan province. On December 29th, an Afghan soldier shot and killed 2 members of the French Foreign Legion in eastern Afghanistan. 10 days later, during a volleyball game on a base in Zabul province, an Afghan soldier murdered an unarmed American. In January 2012, a video of U.S. Marines kicking and urinating on Taliban corpses appeared on YouTube. It went viral and generated news coverage worldwide. On January 20th, on a base in remote Kapisa province, an Afghan soldier murdered 4 unarmed French soldiers while they ran for exercise. The killer later told investigators that he was outraged by the abuse video. One problem was that Afghanistan's Ministry of Defense had no counterintelligence capabilities, no systems or trained personnel to detect Taliban infiltrators or other insiders who posed a threat. The Afghan Spy Service, the National Directorate of Security, or NDS, did have counterintelligence officers. Yet the NDS had roots in Afghanistan's brutal period of Soviet occupation, when the KGB had trained and supported the security service. The Afghan army's leaders had long memories, and they did not want KGB-trained officers rooting around in the Afghan National Army's ranks, looking for Taliban spies, inevitably roughing up innocents or torturing suspects into false confessions. The latest murders revived attention to Borden's work. General Allen read summaries of the study and looked into its history, but he thought that if Petraeus didn't think the work was credible, then it probably wasn't. Allen told colleagues that Borden seemed too hooked on culture and misunderstanding as a problem between Afghan and American forces. Allen had commanded in Iraq on battlefields where American and Iraqi soldiers fought side by side in circumstances that were at least as challenging as in Afghanistan. Of course, there were frictions, but they were not fatal to the mission and could be overcome with deliberate work. Allen was wary, too, about how politically convenient the cultural incompatibility thesis was at a time when public opinion in Europe and America was swinging against the war. Was this reliable social science, or just an excuse to go home? Allen's intuition was that the murders more likely constituted an insurgent strategy of infiltration and disruption, a deliberate strike at the core of NATO cohesion. That winter, one of General Allen's lieutenants, Major General Sean McFarland, put together a self-protection guidebook for NATO soldiers called the Green on Blue Smart Card. It advised, "The key is for local commanders to prevent complacency and conduct risk assessments with Green on Blue in mind." The Smart Card recommended that NATO officers include Afghan partners and promote cultural sensitivity. "Respect Islam," the guidebook suggested, and "avoid arrogance." Commanders should involve Afghan soldiers and officers in patrol briefings and social sport activities, the document urged. Yet it also laid out procedures for how to train for gun battles with inside murderers, how to eliminate shooters decisively and quickly, and how to maintain armed vigilance, including the oversight of Afghan allies, before, during, and after military operations. Wednesday, 2/15/2012, 9:44 a.m. Holly. I had another Afghan hands experience today. General Dawood invited Nia, another APH in our office, to his house for lunch today. The main reason was so Nia could talk to his wife about her health condition, so we can try to set up some treatment for her if necessary. So we donned our civilian clothes and hopped in his police truck and went to his house. It was an extremely modest setup, not at all like one might think a general would live in. We had the standard Afghan meal of rice, bread, beef, chicken, and salad, and it was tasty. In true Afghan fashion, they insisted we eat more and more. We believe the reason they live so modestly is that they spend a lot of their money on education. His wife teaches geography, and the other two women, I think they were daughters or nieces, teach math, all at the same high school. Nia also pointed out that the reason he may be waiting so long to pin on his second star is that he is honest, leads an honest yet modest lifestyle, and refuses to pay a bribe to get his star pinned on. That's just speculation on our part, but it's plausible. I just thought you'd like to know of my adventure today. L. D. 2. In early 2012, the largest American-run prison in Afghanistan was the detention facility at Parwan, adjacent to Bagram Airfield, about 40 miles north of Kabul. Taliban prisoners detained there used the facility as a makeshift command center, passing messages to one another and outside. ISAF had assigned a military police unit and a theater intelligence group counterintelligence team to stop the Taliban prisoners from communicating. In late 2011 and early 2012, the team received multiple intelligence reports that the Taliban were using books in the prison library as a medium of communication within the detainee population. On February 18th, about a dozen American soldiers and civilian linguists searched the prison library. One of the linguists identified books that he thought contained extremist content. He concluded upon further investigation that perhaps two-thirds to three-quarters of the library's books and pamphlets should not be read by prisoners. On this advice, the American counterintelligence team pulled aside about 2,000 books and decided to burn them. The team included only a handful of Arabic and Pashto speakers. Only they understood clearly that the books included copies of the Holy Quran. The team hauled the offending books to a burn pit. Afghan colleagues warned them not to go forward because they feared locals working at the incinerator would recognize religious materials in the load and might react violently. The leader of the American team heard this warning but did not act. At the burn pit, another Afghan National Army officer and his translator saw Qurans in the pile slated for destruction and again warned the Americans to stop. They too were ignored. Minutes later, an Afghan civilian employee operating the incinerator noticed that Islamic religious books were on fire. He shouted for help, doused the flames, and tried to rescue partially burned Qurans. As word spread, more Afghans rushed to the burn pit. The Americans present became frightened by the growing angry crowd and rapidly departed the area. Darren Loftus turned 44 years old on February 22, 2012. He spoke to Holly that day for 10 or 15 minutes. His colleagues were planning a surprise party for March 28th, which Loftus knew about, to celebrate his return home to Florida. Darren worked for Jean-Marc Lanthier, a Canadian brigadier posted at ISAF headquarters. He held a Shura for ISAF's operations group leadership, known as the J3, most Saturdays. He regarded Loftus as one of the most brilliant human beings I've seen, in or out of uniform. Loftus could afford to be skeptical about ambitious generals, as he once called them. He planned to retire from the army soon and go back to school. In Afghanistan, he would not hesitate to challenge the most senior officers if he felt they had the wrong assumptions. Some of his American and Canadian colleagues would be dismissive of the Afghan point of view, as Lanthier put it, but Loftus would always bring us back to the truth. He tried to make them understand why it was important to let the Afghans do it their way, and yet he hadn't gone native. He would also challenge the Afghans about their assumptions. Lanthier struggled to assess the rising incidence of fratricidal murder. It was uncomfortable to think the Taliban had the ability to threaten the coalition by placing infiltrators in their midst. But Lanthier and his colleagues felt exceptionally safe at the Ministry of Interior. They assumed the ministry's security guards were reliable because Afghan security had vetted the guards to protect Afghan generals who also worked at the compound. The Ministry of Interior was a downtown Kabul fortress ringed by iron fences, concrete walls, barbed wire, and armed guards. There were hundreds of Afghan and international troops on the premises or nearby. When Lanthier visited, he walked around without body armor and asked his bodyguard to stand outside his office to signal to his Afghan colleagues that he trusted them. Afghans were not allowed to carry guns. The compound seemed as secure as any place in Afghanistan. At Forward Operating Base Lone Star, near Jalalabad, in eastern Afghanistan, American soldiers and military police trained Afghan units. T.J. Conrad Jr. of Roanoke County, Virginia, the married father of a one-year-old son, served as an instructor. He had arrived in Afghanistan only in January. During calls home, he told his father, he felt like on some of the patrols they went on that they were being set up by the Afghans they were training, because they would arrive at target compounds, and it seemed that the enemy had been tipped off beforehand. On February 23rd, hundreds of shouting Afghans gathered outside the gates of Lone Star to protest the Quran burnings at Parwan. The Americans shouldered weapons and watched the protesters warily, but held fire. Suddenly, an Afghan soldier on the base trained his automatic rifle on his American colleagues. Conrad sought cover and fired back, but the Afghan soon shot him dead. The shooter killed a second American, Joshua Bourne. Other American soldiers returned fire and wounded the assailant, but he stumbled off the base and into the crowd of protesters. The base's intelligence unit had launched a surveillance drone that day to watch the protesters. The drone's cameras now followed the shooter as he escaped. Outside Lone Star, four people helped him before a large Pashtun man in civilian dress, who had apparently been waiting for the killer, hoisted the wounded man over his shoulder, carried him half a mile on foot, and then loaded him into a white vehicle. The drone followed as the vehicle sped away, but it escaped. General John Allen called his counterpart, Sher Mohammad Karimi, the Afghan Chief of Army Staff, and proposed that they fly together to Lone Star. In the base's small mess hall, where a large American flag had been hung on the wall, they spoke to survivors. "There will be moments like this, when your emotions are governed by anger and the desire to strike back," Allen said. "These are the moments when you reach down inside and you grip the discipline that makes you a United States soldier. And you gut through the pain, and you gut through the anger, and you remember why we are here. We are here for our friends. We are here for our partners. We are here for the Afghan people. Now is not the time for revenge." Karimi spoke. "Your sacrifice is not wasted," he said. "This enemy fighting against us is not an enemy of Afghanistan. It is an enemy of the whole humanity. I think we are fighting together for a noble cause." "We admit our mistake," Allen concluded. "We ask forgiveness. We move on." On the afternoon of Saturday, February 25th, Darren Loftus went to work in the Interior Ministry office he shared with Major Robert Marchanti, a logistics specialist. Marchanti was 48, a bear-sized man with a crew cut. He had served in the Maryland National Guard for 25 years. At home in Baltimore, where he had grown up, he had taught physical education in public schools. This was his first Afghan tour. He was trying to learn Dari and Pashto. He ate regularly with Afghans at their dining hall at the Ministry of Interior. His church back home sent coats and children's gear to him in Kabul that winter. Marchanti distributed the gifts to a local orphanage. For the U.S. Army, his job was to order supplies and manage deliveries around the country. The room Loftus and Marchanti shared was on the second floor of an auxiliary building on the Interior Ministry compound. Marchanti had mounted a Baltimore Ravens pennant on one wall. A map of Afghanistan hung on another wall. Both men had been caught up that week in conversations about the Quran burnings at Parwan. Loftus had pledged to Lanthier to draft a paper that explained Islam and Afghan culture to ISAF soldiers so that, among other subjects, they might better understand the significance of the Quran. Darren Loftus routinely lingered with Afghans on the Interior Ministry compound. He had only a passing acquaintance with Abdul Sabur, a slight man who kept his head shaved. Sabur had managed 2 months earlier to win a transfer from duty as a soldier to a job as an Interior Ministry driver. The new position allowed him greater access to compound buildings. Early in February, Sabur knocked on the door of the office Loftus shared. He asked to have his picture taken with Loftus, Marchanti, and a third American, Colonel Jim Green. They smiled for the camera. "I'm checking the Taliban website tonight," Loftus joked when Sabur was gone. "Our pictures will probably be there." Sabur was an ethnic Tajik who spoke Dari and hailed from the Salang area of Parwan province. This was a profile that seemed to mark him as a reliable American ally. because he belonged to one of the northern Afghan ethnic groups that were in the main ardent enemies of the Taliban. It later emerged, however, that Sabur had left Afghanistan and studied at a Pakistani madrasa before returning to Kabul to take his position.